That is at least the plan, though. You know, I have not yet given a talk at an institute that puts you more off guard other than feeding you a big lunch and then making you run up three flights of stairs to be at your own talk in time. So if I, you know, all of a sudden collapse into a food coma, you'll know why. But yeah, so I'm going to talk about this topic. This is, you know, a topic that I've had a lot of fun working on over the past 3 years with a variety of collaborators. Starting back in 2014 with Anson, Bibushan, and Catherine, then working on some of the more formal field theory and curved space aspects with Hojun and Catherine, and most recently making some serious progress on, you know, putting all the pieces of this picture together with Bibushan, Hojun, Catherine, and Will, who is also here today. And so when I abscond and you think of all those last second questions you wish that you'd ask me, you can just find Will instead and ask him. Right, so yeah, let's get started. So a well-known fact, I'm sure, to everyone in this room is that if you calculate the Standard Model Higgs potential, you find that, you know, we live somewhere over here in the electroweak vacuum, but then at large field values, the potential turns over, and so you get a maximum of the potential, and then you get this very rapid runaway to what is assumedly some large true vacuum that lives way out at large field values. A note on this, so this is written in terms of lambda. I'm going to define lambda to just be the scale at which this turnover occurs. So the fact that I'm here giving this talk is not experimental evidence that this does not happen necessarily, because the lifetime of the electroweak vacuum exceeds the age of our universe. So there's nothing, you know, current observations of existence do not preclude this from being true. And so this is frequently referred to as the metastability of the electroweak vacuum. It's not absolutely stable, but it's sufficiently stable for the observations of our universe. But an interesting question that you can ask, given this scenario, is what about if we had a period of inflation? In other words, how did we seem to be sitting here fine today, but how did we end up in this vacuum in the first place? And so to answer that question, there, you know, in particular, what you might worry about is that during inflation, fluctuations in the Higgs field might allow you to sample the unstable or true vacuum part of the potential that is not in the electroweak vacuum. And so in order to understand the importance of that, you need to basically answer two questions, which are, one, how do the Higgs field fluctuations evolve during inflation? So in other words, that's just testing whether you do sample locally this unstable part of the potential. And second is, if supposing that you do, how does such a large fluctuation impact the surrounding space-time? And so are we allowed to sample that? Can we come back? You know, what is the impact that you might have on the universe if you were to sample the true vacuum?
I was having a hard time reading the axis on the last one. How high is the barrier?
Oh, so the barrier is, you know, unfortunately, this is normalized in terms of this turnover scale to the minus four.
So this,
that's a great question. This scale is in the standard model calculated to be around 10 to the 10 GeV. The turnover, the quartic coupling is about 0.01-ish, 10 to the minus two-ish. So this is, you know, 10 to the 38 GeV to the four, about. So, so we're talking about scales that are way above, you know, we're talking about scales that are way above the scales that we're probing today. I've given this talk a couple times without this slide. I finally decided it is absolutely necessary. Here is the advance warning. Depending on your take on this, I am either going to tell you about an interesting study of an interesting quantum field theory system that is motivated from some things we observe, but in reality, you can keep understanding that in your own mind, supersymmetry appears at 10 TeV, it fixes the instability, and all of this is speculation. Of course, I will assume that the standard model is valid up to high energies. I will make connection to experimental results. But of course, as I mentioned, this turnover happens at 10 to the 10 GeV in the standard model. There's a lot of room between where we are now and where we are going, where you can imagine plenty of forms of new physics that might change the exact shape of the potential. The second trigger warning for people who are more cosmology inclined is that I am going to assume, I am not going to write down, you know, a model of inflation. I'm going to assume, so I'm also going to assume some sort of ideal starting conditions for inflation, which I will get into later, and more specifically for how the Higgs might have behaved during inflation. I'm also going to start with a minimally coupled Higgs, so I'm not going to be running things like non-minimal couplings to curvature. And another thing, and this is, this one should worry you the least or cause the least amount of eye twitching. I'm going to neglect the, so if, as you notice, here I'm talking about the electroweak vacuum as basically being at zero. Obviously, the Higgs has a mass term. The mass term is also affected by, you know, inflationary corrections. All of those effects, as I will discuss near the end, are subleading, but I'm going to neglect them at the very beginning, and so you should just know that they are subleading and you don't need to go, wait, what about the mass term? So with that out of the way, I'm still totally happy to take questions, talk about initial conditions, talk about the setup, talk about how it might be modified by different sorts of new physics, but these are some basic, like these are some simplifying things I'm gonna, simplifying assumptions I'm going to make to talk about the system from the simplest perspective possible to start. So, okay, so let's go immediately on to the first question. How do we model the evolution of the Higgs field fluctuations during inflation? Well, there are two contributions to the Higgs field. There are two contributions to the Higgs evolution, the local evolution of the field, where when I say local, I'm going to mean spatially averaged over a patch that is on the order of the Hubble, like is on the order of a Hubble volume during inflation. So the first is something that you're familiar with from the behavior of sort of any, you know, massless scalar field or a scalar field that has a negligible potential during inflation. So that might be if you've thought about the axion, you know, this is something that happens to the axion, but it's also something that just happens to the fluctuations of the inflaton among around the homogeneous background. You know, in this slow roll approximation, those fluctuations are effectively massless. They effectively have a very small potential. But so for any sort of scalar field like that, we know that the field undergoes some sort of stochastic evolution. And what this corresponds to is as you have fluctuating modes freeze out during inflation, those have some characteristic those modes freeze out some characteristic sizes on the order of h on 2 pi. And this leads to a local field value that is a sum over all the modes that have frozen out. And so as you sort of get each mode horizon crossing, that mode might be fluctuating up, it might be fluctuating down, it might add coherently or destructively with the previous modes that have frozen out. And so, but the result of this is that you end up getting a field profile that comes from these subsequent freezing out of modes. So here is my rendition, which means it's very far from an artist's rendition of sort of the picture you should have here, which is if I imagine that the Hubble patch, if this is the value of the Higgs field and this is just one spatial dimension, if I imagine this sort of small patch somewhere on this axis represents, you know, a Hubble patch, then various modes have frozen out with wavelengths longer than the horizon size than this Hubble patch. And then the actual Higgs value is the sum over all these modes. And so I could say that, oh, in this little Hubble patch, that is the value of the Higgs field. So that is the usual sort of fluctuations that you're familiar with, as I mentioned, for any scalar field. But there is, of course, a second important effect, which is the Higgs potential. And the Higgs potential can serve, you know, the Higgs potential, as you saw, it has, you know, some sort of minimum structure, but then it also has this runaway large field values. And so that can either cause these fluctuations to shrink or it can cause them to grow, depending on exactly how large the field value is and where you're sampling in the potential. So how do you model both of these? Well, the state of the art for modeling these is known as the Fokker-Planck equation. So the Fokker-Planck equation treats the Higgs as basically a sort of test particle in a thermal background, or at least that's what you would talk about if you were talking about it from a statistical mechanics perspective. You'd think about the Fokker-Planck equation in that context is usually applied to a particle in like a thermal bath. And so there is some net driving force coming from the potential, and there is also some thermal noise term, which corresponds to the fluctuations. And so the and what this gives you is it gives you the probability that in any one of these sort of Hubble-sized patches, you find a local field value H at a given time t. And so this was first applied to the case of the Higgs by these authors back in 2007. A very nice piece of work, but there were some details missing, and in particular, a few mistaken boundary conditions that altered their results somewhat. But so that's what we're going. That's the way that we are going to model how the Higgs fluctuations evolve, and that's what's going to tell us whether and how frequently these local fluctuations in the Higgs field lead to sampling the unstable part of the potential. And so you can see, as mentioned, the stochastic noise term, and also some net effect due to the potential. So that, you know, this is a system that gives us a way to study the Higgs field fluctuations, but, you know, one question is you look at this and you say, okay, great, but I calculated this potential that I'm interested in, you know, in the standard model. And so I did the usual procedure with, you know, two loop running, one loop matching. I included Coleman-Weinberg type terms, and I got something like this. And so a question that you can ask is, okay, well, now I'm in an inflationary background. What is the right potential to be using in the Fokker-Planck equation? And so this is, I think, a very interesting exercise, you know, like working out. To some people, this might be, you know, for a long time, it was not obvious to a lot of people what this potential should be. And so I think it's interesting to think through it as a sort of exercise in Wilsonian field theory. And so what would Wilsonian reasoning lead you to believe the potential should be? So let's do that. First of all, you know, the first thing you would do if you were talking about an EFT is you'd say, okay, well, what are my degrees of freedom? Well, the Fokker-Planck equation describes superhorizon modes, right? As I said, everything that I'm imagining that goes into and comes out of here is averaged over a Hubble-sized patch. So I'm basically integrating out everything that is subhorizon. Well, it turns out that the mode functions, while the mode functions of scalars freeze out outside the horizon, the mode functions of fermions and gauge bosons rapidly decay. So that means that that when you're talking about a theory of superhorizon physics, you don't really have degrees of freedom corresponding to the fermions or corresponding to the gauge bosons. So that means that the potential, at first glance, looks quite simple. It's just a potential containing the Higgs, right? Those are my only degrees of freedom. And so it's not, for example, some complicated one-loop effect of Coleman-Weinberg thing where I have to be worried about, you know, everything else. But this potential, as we know, is not entirely simple because it has a quartic coupling, and the quartic coupling needs to take some value. And so a question is then, okay, well, what parameters do I put in? What is the actual value that I should use for this quartic coupling? And I would say that Wilsonian reasoning also leads you to believe that it's simply that you need to choose the renormalized coupling constant at the right scale. And so in this case, you realize that, you know, fermions and gauge bosons don't contribute outside the horizon where their mode functions rapidly decay. But if you consider going to the very deep UV, in the very deep UV, basically these particles feel like they're in flat space, right? So as long as I'm at high enough energies, these particles will, you know, these modes will contribute, they will couple to the Higgs. And so in particular, what I expect them to do is to renormalize the quartic coupling as if I were in Minkowski space. So the Wilsonian approach would lead you to believe, okay, well, so how do I get to this theory from the standard model calculation that I do? Well, what I do is I'm going to, I know in flat space the coupling at all energies, so I'm going to just run it all the way up to the Planck scale. And then I'm going to run the standard model down from the UV. And as I would normally, whenever I hit a threshold that is the place that I'd normally integrate out a state, I'm going to integrate out that state. And in particular, the scale at which the mode functions of the fermions and gauge bosons and all of, in fact, the subhorizon physics should be integrated out, a good choice of scale for that to, you know, suppress large logarithmic effects and make sure that the scales are integrated out at the right threshold is here. And so there are a couple of consistency checks that you can do for this. First of all, if I just imagine turning off the Higgs-Vev, then as mentioned, fermions engage bosons decouple at the horizon scale. So they renormalize you down in the UV to the horizon scale and then they decouple. However, if I imagine turning off the Hubble constant instead and thinking of this in flat space, then you'd be back to the usual flat space case, which is the good choice to make the logarithm small, is that you take the, you basically put in a renormalization scale that is the mass of these states. These states get their mass from the Higgs, so that means that the correct scale, you know, up to these small differences in coupling constants, is that mu is approximately h, is a good choice that's usually taken. And so this can also be verified by explicit computation. Particularly, you can calculate the effective potential in de Sitter space, and you can see what a good choice is to minimize the logarithms. We can also see this another way, which is you could say, okay, well, what, like, this is a quantum field theory. What is a quantum field theory really supposed to be doing for me? Well, what it's really supposed to be doing is allowing me to calculate correlators. And so if you imagine that what I told you the Fokker-Planck equation did is it gave you the spatially averaged field value over a Hubble-sized patch, you would say, well, then what this should do is this should allow me to calculate some correlator. You know, and indeed, if you look back at the original Fokker-Planck formalism, what a lot of people, you know, what it was sort of realized to do was to be able to calculate these, you know, Hubble-sized correlators, where here a coincident correlator corresponds to, as mentioned, you know, local is the value in a patch. But so what you can do is you can say, okay, well, what if I were just calculating this correlator from QFT? Right, and then you'd say, okay, well, if I did this calculation in a toy h to the fourth theory, you know, and I calculated these diagrams, so yeah, I have some one loop contribution, some higher loop contribution. It turns out that these contributions, the contributions of these scalars regulated, would give you something that looked like some contribution from the UV plus some contribution from the IR. And where you get these extra terms because you get these terms you might not be used to because you're, of course, plugging in now not just the usual plane wave solutions, but the plane waves in de Sitter space. So I get these extra contributions. Then if I went to a renormalization procedure you're probably, you know, more used to, like I went to using something like MS bar, then I get two terms. I get, first of all, from this growth relative, my IR cutoff being, you know, whatever my patch was initially all the way to the UV, I get some leading IR logarithm, which gives me some growth and fluctuations related to the number of e-folds. And I also get this, I also get, you know, some logarithm as I would normally. And if I go to what happens with fermions and gauge bosons, well, they don't actually contribute over this whole range because as I mentioned, their wave functions are suppressed for the first part of this integral, which goes from a naught h all the way up to ah. So those are all the superhorizon modes, all those mode functions suppressed. So in this case, I only get the contribution from some ah up to a lambda. And so in that case, I don't get this growth with n, but I do still get a logarithm. And so, as mentioned, what I want to do then is I want to choose a renormalization scale that's going to minimize these logarithms in the calculation of correlators. And so that is another way to see the motivation for this choice. Okay, so now we've got a good setup. We've got a Fokker-Planck equation, which is going to allow us to model the evolution of the fluctuations. And we also know what we should put in as the potential. And so now, with the help of, you know, experts at numerical simulations, like Will here, who, you know, you can't see blush because you're all facing the back of his head, so he chose his seat strategically. You can go through and you can actually numerically calculate for the Higgs potential in the standard model and for a particular choice of the Hubble constant, how does the probability distribution evolve? So I'm like always excited to do this in these talks because, you know, you don't get to show a lot of simulations if you're a BSM phenomenologist. So what this is gonna, so I get to actually show a video. This is very exciting for me. So what this is gonna be is this is gonna be the log of the probability distribution. This is the Hubble, this is the value of the field. So this is gonna evolve with the number of E folds. And then two things that, you know, will make a little bit more sense shortly, but for the time being, just to sort of guide their eyes, your eyes, there's this line. This line corresponds approximately, this line corresponds to pretty close to where the potential is maximized. It's in fact just slightly beyond. And then this line corresponds to actually where the Fokker-Planck formulation breaks down. And so if you watch this black curve, see I'm like building up to it because I'm so excited to show it, but so that you guys have something to look at, you can see how this probability distribution evolves. And so E fold is progressing, we're getting some growth and fluctuations, and then we start seeing this big growth and fluctuations, you know, this big long tail to the probability distribution at the end. And so, sorry, yes.
What do you mean by the Fokker-Planck equation breaks down?
Pardon? Oh, so the Fokker-Planck equation is derived in the, assuming basically slow roll evolution for the Higgs, so you use part of the input to get it is the equation of motion. You use the equation of motion, the slow roll approximation. So this is just where that approximation is no longer valid. So you really sort of expect this tail to look somewhat different out here. But I'll get onto the importance of that in a second.
Slow roll accounts there is the slow roll for the background or for the Higgs?
So I'm just assuming a pure de Sitter background. And so the slow roll I'm talking about there is the slow roll for the Higgs. So I'm just saying that that Fokker-Planck equation I showed you had some V prime on 3H and it was related to one time derivative. That's because I've dropped a second time derivative term. And that's, you know, implicitly slow roll for the Higgs in a de Sitter background.
So related to that, so when into this calculation was you're using the vanilla Fokker-Planck with the massless noise, and then the leading, you know, V prime driving term. And then the V, you're saying you do a loop correction to V. So the reason you care about scale of lambda is you put in a loop correction to the potential at one loop level with that value of lambda.
Yes, exactly. So in this case, you know, for, like over in this regime where H is small, I'm basically evaluating at mu corresponding to an order of magnitude below the Chernyshev scale.
So have you thought about, you know, the Fokker-Planck equation itself has corrections, which if you start correcting things in the potential, you know, the noise also gets corrections. So have you thought about the relative size of those to the ones you're keeping?
I mean, we've thought about it. So we have thought about it and convinced ourselves that it is largely subdominant.
What suppresses it?
Well, I guess that's a little bit like the corrections to the noise you would expect to come from being due to interactions between the field, right? Which should, in some sense, be captured by the potential.
Pardon, even if you have a mass field, it turns out the noise is no longer h cubed over h pi squared because there's mass corrections.
Right, so we're neglecting the mass in this case, so that could that would certainly be a correction. We're basically taking the leading corrections as coming from the quartic interactions, which are captured by the potential, and then massless noise.
So the regime is that the Hubble scale is much bigger than the Higgs to make the masses small, and then lambda small.
Yeah. So my hesitation is like out here at the very tail is what I'm worried about. Like some of those corrections might be more relevant. The thing that I think is the saving grace is actually so what this line really corresponds to is where the classical motion due to the potential takes over. So what I really think is, like, it's sort of a bit of a hodgepodge, which is in the sense that in here, like, when you're, like, yes, as you said, the Hubble correction is dominating, so you don't have necessarily big corrections, and so you're primarily being driven by the noise term, but you're mostly in a regime where the potential is not a big effect, like, it is subdominant to the noise term anyway. Then you get out here, and there might, like, the potential is more relevant, so those might be corrections to the, there might be corresponding corrections to the noise term, but you're being driven by the potential term anyway. Like, the noise is just a fluctuation on top of that. So that's like some sort of dividing between the regimes. But yeah, thank you. That's a good question. But so yeah, so just a, you know, so in one other thing that's going to be relevant for a comparison I'm going to make on the next slide is if you look at these dotted lines, so if you just had normal H on 2 pi fluctuations with, you know, stochastic fluctuations with no potential whatsoever, that would give you this dot dashed line. If you had a potential that was just purely, you know, you just use some Gaussian approximation with a potential that was just purely evaluated at this scale, which as you notice is below the turnover scale, that would suppress those fluctuations somewhat. And you can see that the full distribution looks quite different from either of these Gaussian approximations. So what are the main interesting features about this? Well, first of all, the probability distribution exhibits long tails. You get really rapid spreading out. You get really rapid spreading out in this regime due to this growth from the potential. So that's due to the unstable potential. So why is that relevant? Well, one reason it's relevant is that inflation is going to produce many, many patches. And so even if you have, you know, these very exponentially suppressed probabilities that I was showing, once you form those patches, they do start to quite rapidly diverge. And, you know, in my many patches, there's a good chance, that I have at least one, you know, patch that has reached the unstable regime and then really started running away. And so that leads to the question, which is if I do form one of these patches, even if it's very, very rare, you know, because I have so many patches being formed, if I do form one, what are the implications for the inflationary history of our universe?
Is the final curve you got, if you took the static solution of the Fokker-Planck equation, it would have been e to the minus v over h to the fourth or something.
So the e to the minus v over h to the fourth is the, like you said, the static solution. The problem is that solution only, so like all the things you've seen of that, those, the derivations always assume a normalizable bounded potential. We're working with a not normalizable, unbounded potential. So the equilibrium solution is all probability flows out, right? Like you expect everything to eventually tunnel over to the true vacuum region because that's the very deep, very distant. Or, you know, if I do want to talk about it in that e to the minus v over h to the fourth, what I would say is like, you know, there is one very, very large v. So, you know, where I stopped the video was at 60 e folds.
So if you kept it going, it would have kept going.
Yeah, it would have kept sloughing out. Yeah, exactly. And I will also hopefully, I'm looking at the time and I'm hoping that I'm going to get to that as well. But if not, I'd like love to chat about it a little bit afterwards. Okay, so the fate of large fluctuations. So what happens to these large fluctuations? Well, first of all, I have to define what I mean by large. So what are the various regimes? So the first regime is that I have some fluctuation that is within my barrier. Well, those, as you saw, those grow due to inflationary fluctuations, but their growth is somewhat suppressed by this quartic effect. Then, however, if I'm beyond the barrier, I have this negative quartic and my field starts to grow rapidly. But that doesn't mean, but like the Fokker-Planck, I'm in a de Sitter background is still a good setup because the overall inflationary energy density is, you know, I'm still like the Higgs is still basically evolving in what is a predominantly inflaton dominated background. Then as I mentioned, there is this place where all of a sudden the slow roll approximation involved in the Fokker-Planck equation breaks down. And so if you just were to solve the standard equations of motion, you would see that at this point, the Higgs field starts growing very, very rapidly as you would expect from slow roll violation. And this leads to any sort of local fluctuation growing very, very rapidly until the energy density in the Higgs becomes comparable to the energy density in the inflaton. And so at that point, I can no longer obviously just consider this as evolving in a static background because now I need to talk about what does the back reaction look like. And so when I say a large fluctuation, what I'm going to be talking about is I'm going to be talking about some fluctuation that starts here, because as I mentioned, that's where I can track it to in the Fokker-Planck equation. And then I'm going to see what happens as you go from here to here and get back reaction on the space-time. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about when I talk about the fate of a large fluctuation. Yeah, Joe, did you have a question?
Your answer.
Oh, good. I paid him to do that. Right, so, okay, so that's a large fluctuation. So what does it look like when they grow? Okay, so this is, you know, my second chance to show videos. These are some great simulations done by Will. What is going to happen here is in the center of this plot, you can't see it, but there is a fluctuation that has been set up, a Gaussian fluctuation, that is at this place where slow roll starts to break down. And so this is going to show the Higgs relative to, you know, some reference value, and this is going to show the energy density. And this is also the point where I get to take a poll. I can try to like click really quickly twice and get them to run at the same time-ish, or I can do one at a time. Who wants to see them both at the same time?
Both.
Who wants to see one at a time?
You're going twice and you both.
Pardon? Can I do them? I guess the third option here is also who is like recovering from a food coma and just realized they were asked a question and so just sort of stuck their hand up. Okay, well, we had it by an overwhelming vote of 1 to 1/2, because someone like kind of raised their hand. I'll try to do them both at once. So you see, you know, at the beginning of an e-fold, remember when this gets to 1, that's an e-fold. You know, you're not really seeing much happening. And you see that this fluctuation is starting to grow. And then all of a sudden, craziness.
Sorry, how do you evolve this? So this is not no longer with the Fokker-Planck equation.
This is done using numerical general relativistic simulations.
So you're evolving the fields that solve the classical field equations given the initial distribution depth.
No, this would basically be like sampling one point in the Fokker-Planck equation, like that's at that slow roll breakdown point, putting that in a background with a cosmological constant, and then modeling it spatially just according to, you know, the classical equations.
So your initial data came from the Fokker-Planck equation, and then after that, the evolution is.
Right. So the idea is that the more general picture is that the Fokker-Planck equation is going to tell us what the ensemble of patches is doing.
Yeah.
And then we're going to pick out, and so that tells us like what's happening over a Hubble, that tells us how the fluctuation is growing over a Hubble-sized region. Then we're going to pull out one of those patches where we've really gotten to a large field value, and then we're going to see what happens to that patch in what we assume is the largely inflaton-dominated background.
And in that last part, you're just solving the field equation.
Yep. Exactly.
Does this include gravity?
Yes, it does.
And it's one fixed comovian size, comovian patch?
You mean the axis?
Yeah.
The system? Yeah, I believe it.
What we're saying is one fixed comovian.
Yeah, so these coordinates correspond to the comovian.
Yeah.
And just evolve with proper time forward?
It's not quite proper time, but. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's like that time corresponds to like the usual distributed time. So.
So edge there is using the initial distributed time, although some region might involve a different.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what you see here is you see that this white region appeared, which is not on the plot. So what actually happened in the simulation is the Higgs field started, you know, this fluctuation was growing, because I told you it was violating slow roll. This is a point where it's going to grow rapidly. It's growing. Then it starts growing very rapidly. And then at some point, it just takes off. The field reaches a true vacuum. The field reaches this true vacuum that we've put in. But as I will mention, is, you know, where we put it does not affect this behavior at all. And then as the field reaches this very large value and starts reaching towards the true vacuum, the energy density due to the Higgs potential is negative. And so this is, as you can see in this blue shell here, this is a large negative energy density. So that leads to sort of local contraction of the space-time, which is opposed to what you're used to with, you know, a field redshifting in an expanding background. Now you've got like local contraction, and so the field starts blue shifting. And so what you get is, you know, so several notable features of this are, first of all, from the slow roll breakdown to the true vacuum took less than or around one E fold. Now the reason I mentioned that is because I think that that motivates that this is a good place to start looking at these patches, because whatever you imagine ends inflation, if I had some patch that reached slow roll violation and then this entire, these dynamics that I'm going to discuss were to occur, they're going to occur really, really rapidly. And so this is not, like, I don't care what you think about very rapid thermalization and reheating, it's not going to happen within one E-fold, you know, one inflationary E-fold. So these are patches that once it gets to this point, you expect basically during inflation, whatever just happened in those simulations is going to happen. So the second, so what's actually happened is that you're getting this local contraction that's leading to this blue shift of the rolling Higgs energy density. That's leading to, and so then all of a sudden at some point, if you noticed in the second simulation, there we go. So if you watch the second simulation, you can see that at some point the energy density, you know, it starts going negative because of the large Higgs value, and then it just shoots up and goes crazy as a result of, you know, these Higgs oscillations and this blue shifting, and that large energy density leads to the development of an apparent horizon, or in other words, a black hole. And so what this white region is this is a region that's been excised because of the black hole. It is no longer in causal contact with what is around it. And so the system that you see is you see that a black hole develops at the center of the fluctuation and is growing, but it's compensated for by the shell of surrounding negative energy density. And so what that means is that means that this is not, you know, your simple straightforward bubble nucleation. It is not a bubble of ADS space inside a bubble of DS space. It's actually very complicated dynamically. But where you have this broad Hubble-sized fluctuation, it's more like a Hawking-Moss instanton, you have some dynamical behavior, and so what you end up getting is this system where you have this black hole that's within a negative energy density shell, and the important thing is they're expanding. So you might have said, oh, well, you know, I'm getting local contraction, so maybe once I get over there, like everything contracts and it crunches, and then I just have some weird defect, you know, that gets inflated away, so why do I really care if I locally get one patch? Well, the reason you really care is because that patch is going to continue growing throughout inflation, and in fact, this blue line is taking the Minkowski limit, so that shows you that it's going to continue growing. And sorry, this is the this is basically the radius of the, you know, this is a measure of time, and this is basically the radius of the this is basically the radius of, you know, either the fluctuation or this sort of true vacuum region where you've, you know, got a large negative energy density. And so they're both gonna grow. And so if I form one of these patches during inflation, it's not going to shrink. It's not going to turn into a defect. It is gonna grow throughout inflation and persist.
So the fractional volume in these things, is that growing or is that?
I think it is. It approaches growing at the same fraction as like inflation, basically. So basically, it tends towards expanding in the, you know, at the same rate as the rest of the space is due to inflation. So you can sort of think of it as being kind of like stretched by the fact that everything around it isn't inflating.
Because in your grandmother's, you know, bubble thing, the problem with those things is that they don't complete it somewhat, right? The things inflate outside, and then the fact that you've got things that are forming new vacua is largely irrelevant in the visitor space because there's so few, and they never take over in volume or anything.
Right, so that would happen here too. Like, this is not taking over the entire space during inflation, but the point is that it's persisting during inflation, and we know inflation ends.
It's kind of a fixed fraction.
Right.
What's the fraction?
Pardon?
As a function of your parameters, what sets the fraction you end up with that's in this new phase?
I think it would probably be related, you know, in our case, we're just setting it up to be, you know, we're not varying a lot the parameters. We're just setting it up to be like a Hubble-sized patch at the beginning, and then it approaches a...
Could I turn a knob to make it be a big fraction? Is there one of the parameters in your problem setting that I can make? Make this be a, you know, order one fraction?
I guess Cliff is asking about the global ratio of like how many of these might occur if you have a big region to simulate.
I think that's the probability density that's beyond that dotted line in the original thing.
Yeah, so I mean, one way you could look at it is you could, like, in at least our setup, what you would want to talk about is like the overall fraction of space that forms these things, and then you could talk about, yeah, like, you could assume that all of those regions.
Does that depend on the initial distribution?
Not strongly, I don't
know.
The
final outcome of the Sparkle plant simulation, basically.
I mean, as you take the number of people to infinity, the portion of this will go to one, right? In this.
Yes. Yeah, in the.
And sort of a follow-on question. So, I mean, as inflation progresses, your co-movement horizon is going to shrink. And so, if I talked about a patch later on in inflation fluctuated to this ADS minimum, you know, physically, once everything re-enters the horizon during heating, whatever, after inflation ends, that's going to be a smaller patch later on in inflation than to happen.
No, but that's the point. It's grow, like, it is growing with the, in this case, it is growing with the surrounding space. So it's not like that forms a single Hubble-sized patch, and then that just remains this Hubble-sized patch while, like, you know, and just persists in physical volume. It's going to keep growing with the space.
Does it depend on the initial size of that patch? Or in other words, I could even think about inside of a co-moving horizon or inside of a Hubble patch, a small region enters this ADS minimum, but I don't have to have the whole thing entering this ADS minimum.
Right. No, so another way I might say that is, let's suppose I work close to the place, and then there is some, you know, I put some small local wave on top of that, right? And then that pushes me over the boundary, and then that part of the space starts growing. So one thing to remember is, surprisingly, there's going to be like gradient smoothing, right? So it's not quite as easy as that. It's not like just once I'm close, I add like a tiny bit and all of a sudden it goes crazy due to the spatial gradients, which are suppressed for things that are beyond the horizon. But the second thing is, in principle, you'd expect it to be a small correction, right? Like if you want to just add some sort of random slop, you don't expect all of that slop to add to coherently give you like one giant delta function all of a sudden. And what I'm going to be doing is a probabilistic analysis anyway, so.
But you're telling me if any one of these patches fluctuates the ADS minimum, it's going to grow and it's going to be, you know, catastrophic.
Right.
That's basically what you're saying. And I'm just wondering why there isn't like a function of the parameters of, you know, how deep that ADS well is compared to the energy in the de Sitter space.
Right.
So that's
a good question. And like, part of the point on that, is that the initial growth of this region, like that sort of shell that I showed you, where you're in like the true vacuum and there's a negative energy density, that initial growth is actually space-like. And so this is another reason that this bubble is not, you know, the typical, you know, you shouldn't really think, or I say bubble, if you ever submit this to a journal and you don't just put bubble in quotes, some referee will ignore the quotes and just think you're talking about a bubble. But bearing in mind that when I say bubble, I mean like this sort of spherical region. Its initial growth is space-like. And the reason for that is because what's happening is not that this is something that's nucleating and sweeping outwards, but what's happening is that once the field gets to a certain value, it starts running away very quickly. And so sort of you were saying like, well, is the growth of this related to like the energy differences? Well, as long as, you know, this turnover happens at 10 to the 10. As long as I put the minimum like not right around the corner, the actual growth that is, like the actual runaway in growth that is happening is like that's determined by the slope of the potential. And that's what's causing this region to rapidly grow, because that's what's causing these adjacent regions to rapidly fall away to the true vacuum. The growth of the bubble is not actually being determined by the usual Coleman-DeLucia comparison between my vacuum and the vacuum I'm going to and what is the energy difference there. Does that make sense? It's actually being determined by this runaway in the potential. Right, and the fact that these things are running away such that this region is expanding in a space-like fashion exactly tells you that that runaway is not sensitive, like it's not actually in some sense sensitive to the adjacent point. It's not sensitive to what's happening in the interior of the bubble. And so that's why this system like can expand and persist, because it you know, the edge of the bubble is growing. It doesn't sort of know that it's in, you know, it is not like, in some sense, in a global ADS space. So.
So once again, so if you draw a Penrose diagram, then the
please do not ask me to.
Will be less than 45.
Yes. Degrees. Yes, and
the end of, so I guess what people are asking, if you think we reach a Penrose diagram, like what is it, a straight line? The let's call it domain of steel or whatever.
So you can sort of see from this that it's not, like, the fact that this slope is changing indicates that it is not quite a straight line.
That is physical coordinate of the moon. It's going to be space-like, and it's going to ascend to null.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, but the ascent goes to null. Okay, so if you draw, yeah, is it possible to draw a Penrose diagram?
I can try. This is not exactly the way that I usually, like, I'm just going to go out and say, can we try to construct it afterwards? Because if I try to draw it, I will definitely get myself confused.
Sure.
But, and it's like I said, it's not, you know, it like the problem is it's not like a growing ADS space.
Yes.
So when you say, can you draw a Penrose diagram?
No, I want with the representation of most of the space in the theater, so I can draw a Penrose diagram.
No, I know, but I'm saying that you want me to draw a line corresponding to just the, like corresponding to?
Well, I guess usual bubble, fluctuation of bubble in the center space, we kind of know how it looks like. You have,
yeah, but so.
You have a cone that's a different vacuum. So I was just trying to compare this usual situation to your situation. Again, there's some boundary between
It'll be a little bit different because my acid took that, right?
Yeah.
But then there's a mass.
It's rotated 90 degrees roughly.
But it's different only in the beginning, but then it is. But
right,
then
they're saying it starts out space-like, so it starts out doing something really weird, and then it asymptotes towards, you know, a null or a light bug. So, I mean, that's
so starting out space-like really just a technical statement. It depends on where you draw the boundary between two regions.
Yeah.
Right,
you
exactly.
You can draw something null, you can draw this one, you can draw something else, which is that one.
Yeah, but that's not a problem.
What am I calling the bubble? So.
Right, exactly, and the point is exactly that this is not a well-defined, like, oh, I've got a thin wall bubble, and so I can say that here is the wall. Like, when we're drawing this, what we're defining, like, we have to make some choices is, like, if you remember, I showed you that, and I told you there was a fluctuation there that was, you know, it was at some point that was, you know, where slow roll was breaking down. Well, that's sort of what I'm calling the initial, that value of the Higgs is what I'm defining as like the edge of my initial fluctuation. And then the region where you're actually getting close to the true vacuum and you have this negative energy density, that's what I'm calling the edge of the true vacuum. And that is a region of space-time that is expanding, but it is not, if you do this, you know, here you can see a little bit of weird behavior, and that has to do exactly with the fact that we're having to, you know, to talk about these things in a way where you can try to make connections to the Coleman-DeLucia bubble. We're having to define, you know, where we draw the boundaries of these.
Yeah, but so. How it seems like observation, it's not much different from nucleating usual bubbles. I mean, the problem is like, do they percolate, or how many? I mean, when you reheat, you need to calculate, okay, how many of those bubbles?
Yeah, no, it's,
in the,
certainly.
You know,
yeah, how many
bubbles on the sky the observer sees?
Right.
As far as this calculation goes, that would seem to be different from just nucleating other bubbles, right? Because you don't really care what they do in the beginning as long as
it's observing. It's going to be a bit.
Well, but
the
observer. But this.
Observing is something.
it's still going to hit them at the speed of light. But the question that we were going after here was, like, I agree, the end result of forming one of these regions is going to be the same as nucleating to a true vacuum bubble. But the question we were trying to answer is, like, for example, in that initial paper I showed, they said, oh, well, this bubble has very negative energy density. It's just going to immediately crunch before any of that happens. And so what happens immediately is exactly of interest to this question, because we need to know, as soon as it forms, is there anything weird that is going to prevent it from just doing what you might expect it to do? And so that's actually why, so this paper that I'm mentioning here, they just did an ABS bubble in a de Sitter background, and they found that it, you know, like, the fact that it's ABS does not prevent the bubble from growing in the de Sitter background. And so that's, like, our results are, like, even though the bubble doesn't look like the bubble they're considering, the result is consistent ultimately, which is that these regions do grow. So one other thing that might be more interest to the cosmologists, Savas?
So after heating, you are left with what? What are these objects?
So you're left with these sort of black holes surrounded by shells of negative energy density that also continue to expand in a Minkowski background.
Within our space.
Yes. Actually, once we are in a roughly Minkowski background, they just sort of convert space around. They expand, converting space around them to, you know, similar things to themselves. So they would destroy the electroweak vacuum. And so I'm going to get onto the implications of that in just a second. So one final note that's of particular interest is there's something called the hoop conjecture, which is that, you know, you can take black holes in de Sitter space and draw hoops around them from any direction. One interesting thing, the hoop conjecture does not hold an ABS space. And so this is an interesting system because it sort of ends up as a hodgepodge. Because you have, like, we actually find that we can do this with all sorts of, you know, there's, if you are imagining an ensemble of patches, there's no reason to believe that I necessarily form a perfectly spherical, you know, fluctuation to start off with. And we've looked at actually, you know, other sorts of configurations. And one interesting thing is you can even form sort of arbitrarily elongated black strings that are sort of sheltered by this ABS bubble in this de Sitter background. And those would, you know, if you just had an arbitrary elongated black string in pure DS, that would violate the hoop conjecture. But here, because you have it sort of inside this ADS, inside DS, you can get violations of the hoop conjecture, which is kind of cool.
So it's like inside ADS, inside DS thing. So if we can make it asymptotically flat if we want, right?
From the perspective of this question?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think, in the end of the day, it's going to be some classical solution of the Skater Einstein equations, which is going to look kind of like a black hole, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, there's not a lot of those. So
well, wait, you can't be flat, you have to know here.
Sorry?
You can't be flat, the no hair theory formulation.
Well, that's, I kind of worried about the no hair terms, yeah. If you got to the end of the day and looked at one of these objects, can you write down a solution for it, or see how it would differ from a black hole, or is it just really a vanilla black hole?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Do you have any? I did not have the impression that you could write down like a static solution.
You can write down like black string solutions in ABS.
So it's not static is the thing. You can't have it.
You can write down like black cylinder solutions that are static in ABS. And so, I mean, that's sort of another indication that these, like, you know, usual black hole topology arguments don't work, and you have negative density.
Okay, it sounds like something you should ask about later, because it sounds like I'm going to take you on a down rabbit hole.
Yeah.
So, when I ask you, I think that we talk.
And that's a good one, because it just had me look at the time, and I realized I am getting close to the singularity. That's another feature of the talk. The bubble wall comes through as soon as I'm done. So really quickly, what are the implications for our universe? Well, as we've sort of been alluding to, so I won't belabor this slide too much, but we know that to give rise to the observed, like the observed patterns in the CMB, we expect that the universe must have undergone at least 50 to 60 e-folds of inflation. So What I can do if I want to make connection to phenomenology is I can take an absolutely minimal assumption, which is, and this is what I was talking about with ideal starting conditions, is like, let's suppose I had some patch that was a potential progenitor of our universe. And in that patch, I had good inflationary initial conditions, which I'm going to assume are basically pure ADS. And also, that patch started in the electroweak vacuum, where once again, I'm neglecting the actual electroweak vacuum because it's a small correction. But so basically, the Higgs started at zero. But we've seen that if any large fluctuations form during the inflation of this patch, it will result in a universe that has within it a region that is in the true vacuum that is going to expand and nucleate after inflation. And like you said, just like a usual Coleman Deluge bubble, it's going to destroy all the electroweak space around it. So we would say that the formation of these bubbles during the inflation of our patch, we couldn't have had that occurred in our past light cone. And so if you do that, one of the minimal sort of things you can do to try to make a connection is you can say, okay, I'm going to require that the probability of that happening is small. In other words, that I can get through the 50 to 60 E folds of inflation from this idealized minimal setup, and I'm not going to form any of these patches. And if you do that, you can find a bound on the inflationary energy scale, supposing you take, say, 60 E folds, and you can actually map that nicely onto these measurements of the top mass and the Higgs mass, because those directly affect the running of the quartic coupling. And so we've got these pretty cool regions. So these are the 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours for MT and MH. This green region is where you are stable, where the Higgs potential is stable all the way up to the Planck scale. I'm not going to tell you what happens there. This blue region is an interesting region. That's where we could have an instability, but the scale of the instability is consistent with our current bounds on R. So in other words, if we live here, the fact that we know that R is less than 0.07 means that we could actually be in this situation where we have an instability, we are metastable today, and we got through inflation without any problems. If we were to see R greater than 0.002, which is sort of the benchmark for future experiments, that would be inconsistent with this entire region of parameter space. So that might be an indication of new physics. And then this white region is the region that's sort of not defined yet till we reach this limit that sort of either becomes blue or becomes red, depending on whether you see something at a greater R or see nothing. And another interesting thing is because the tails of the distribution are so long, once you get to the point where the field's over the barrier, actually those tails are long enough and develop quickly enough that you don't actually change this too much by simply saying, okay, well, you gave me this very safe assumption, which is that none of these patches form during inflation. And so maybe I imagine that something went over the barrier, but then inflation ended, and then I had reheating that stabilized it, and that drove me back. And so, I'm going to relax that. I'm going to say that that's actually, you're being too generous. I just want to know that nothing went over the barrier in the first place. Well, it turns out that the bound from saying that nothing goes over the barrier in the first place is very, very comparable to this. And that's actually something that was missed in earlier works, especially because so many earlier works use this Gaussian approximation. And so they don't realize, and so they do not capture the very important non-Gaussian effects that happen due to the quartic potential in these large tails. And so they get a somewhat weaker bound on the inflationary energy scale as a result. And so I think I'm probably out of time. So I unfortunately won't have time to mention some of these things beyond the minimal story. I would love to talk about them if anyone wants. I will slowly and suggestively flash slides in case anyone has questions. So just to conclude, what are the main takeaways that I want to do? I meant suggestively in the sense of forcing, just not like I'm going to be here. So what are the main takeaways? The main takeaways that are, if you get the Higgs leaving the slow roll regime, you get rapid divergence of the true vacuum. That forms these expanding, I'll call them shells, of negative rho surrounding a black hole. And so, more importantly, the formation of any of these regions is incompatible with the observation of our universe in the electroweak vacuum. And so the implications are that you can start taking this picture and saying, okay, well, this allows me to correlate like a standard model with a certain value of M Higgs and M top with some scale of R. And so it's a very neat interplay between cosmological physics and particle physics. There's also this question of, is this an additional challenge for inflationary models? And one, you know, and that's a question because now you're not just worried about, you know, you might not just be worried about being flat enough for inflation, but you're also worried about like the initial conditions of not just starting with inflation, but also this question of how did you start in the electroweak vacuum? And then you can't leave it. So, you know, that's an interesting challenge. There's also the question of how simple can the reconciliation be? Well, it turns out that actually, even just sort of, you can, it might just be the case that higher dimension couplings between the Higgs and the inflaton are enough to, you know, stabilize the potential sufficiently. And then I think there are a lot of future directions, future questions that you can ask taking this type of system and even going beyond this sort of Higgs-inflaton setup and say, well, you know, are there any model building possibilities where I, you know, have a rare patch occurring and that converts all of space from one VEV to another and, you know, let your imagination run wild? And are there signatures of those sort of transitions? But yeah, so I think this is a very interesting question because I think it brings together, you know, a lot of, you know, brings together field theory, not just flat space field theory, it brings together cosmology, and, you know, you can make connection to impending measurements, things we're interesting about, and, you know, both as a motivation for this question and maybe as a motivation for, you know, what sort of new physics we think. So thank you very much for your time and attention and all the great questions.
Any more questions? Jack is here through today and tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I head out in about mid-afternoon tomorrow.
So now or that until then? If not,
could you scroll through this last few slides slightly slower?
Oh, my best friend. Yeah, I'll just, that's good. Let me buy you a beer later. Let me, it's an easy offer to make given the per diem and the fact that you can't spend it anywhere else. but yeah, so this is just a few quick things you can talk about. So first of all, you know, frequently people talk about the case of having Hubble-sized masses for scalar fields during inflation that could come from something like a coupling to the inflationary potential, or, you know, in SUSY could come from a coupling to whatever, you know, just some term in the Kähler potential between the Higgs and whatever ended up the field whose F term was responsible for driving inflation. And it turns out that if this, you know, had a sort of modest coefficient, then that could be enough to actually, you know, use. It's interesting because then obviously quartics win eventually, so you still have a negative potential, but this, you still have a negative potential at large field values, but this creates a barrier that suspends that long enough that you could get through the required inflation. And actually, even once, you know, now you're also correlating where that barrier is with the size of fluctuations. So once that gets large enough to about a half, then in that case, you just sort of suspend, you're sort of always suspending the barrier further than your tunneling rate. And so that can basically render the electroweak vacuum effectively stable. If you do put in that sort of coupling, one thing you might be worried about is whether the oscillations of the inflaton are sort of going to reintroduce your problem, because now you, that was great when the inflaton wasn't moving and it gave a large mass, but then the inflaton starts oscillating and maybe that leads to a parametric resonance type effect. It's an interesting question. It turns out that the, you know, I leave it to the string theorists to tell me whether there is a 10 to the 3 Planck suppressed coupling, but who knows, maybe this is the unification scale and that's not so weird. So it is an important constraint to take into account. Another question is, you know, could reheating take patches that had, you know, take large fluctuations and drive them back to the electroweak vacuum? This was an analysis done by these authors. Again, they neglected these non-Gaussian effects, so there's not a lot of interesting parameter space in which this can happen, but it's an interesting question. And finally, going back to some of the questions that Cliff was asking, you can say, well, you know, what happens if I like sort of take the long time limit? And so you could, what you eventually happens is you enter a sort of steady state where, you know, those tails are causing you to lose a certain number of patches, a certain proportion of the remaining electroweak patches in each subsequent e-fold of inflation. And so you could start asking questions about like, well, what happens if 50% of the space, you know, you inflate some huge amount and 50% of the space becomes these sort of, you know, true vacuum regions. Well, there's some interesting work by you know, in the context of internal inflation by Sakino, Schenker, and Susskind, where they take, they call it the topological phases of internal inflation, and they think about like, oh, well, could I really have inflation in a space where only 50, you know, where sort of it was half not inflating and half inflating, and they determined that actually that might just lead to a global instability in the space that leads to it all crunching, you know, eventually. And so, you know, you could potentially try to map this onto a bound on a total number of e-folds. Then again, once you start trying to think about inflation beyond what we see, you have these questions of initial conditions and how did you get there in the first place, and, you know, eternal inflation and the measure problem. But, you know, it's an interesting question to think about what would happen if, you know, we did get a pocket universe that looked like ours, but around us there was, you know, more fascinating mass. So thank you.
So let's thanks, people again.